This is Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. Today's program looks at standardized assessment. What should be the role of standardized testing in our schools? Is its current direction problematic? Are there ways to make testing better? In September 2010, the U.S. Department of Education, as part of its Race to the Top competition, awarded $330 million to two coalitions of states to help them develop new ways of measuring whether students are on track to be ready for college and 21st century careers. In other words, meeting the newly developed Common Core State Standards. As one newspaper headline declared, Race to the Top promises new era of standardized testing. Our first guest is Andrew Porter, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania and the George and Diane Weiss Professor of Education. He'll be setting the context for us by giving us some insights into the history of and attachment to standardized testing in this country. Welcome, Dean Porter. Can we start by having you give us some idea of your own background and connection with the topic of standardized testing?
Sure. My first experience with standardized testing was taking them. and then I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin and trained to be what some people call a psychometrician, a person who understands the mathematical models that underlie the construction and reporting of results from tests such as student achievement tests. And currently, most states have a technical panel for their student achievement testing programs, and I chair the technical panel for Ohio and Missouri and Wisconsin. And I'm also a member of federal government group called the National Assessment Governing Board, sometimes called NAGB, which is the policy board for the National Assessment of Education Progress, sometimes called the Nation's Report Card, which is also student achievement testing in K-12 students.
Some people claim that the widespread use of standardized tests as a means of evaluating student capabilities and achievement is unique to the U.S. How true is this?
Well, what the U.S. does is in some ways unique, but it's not unique in the way of whether we use standardized tests or not. So let me just start by saying, what do we mean by a standardized test? And here, I think all of your questions are going to be in the context of K-12 student achievement testing, and so I'll try to keep my comments in that context as well. But the purpose of a standardized test is fairness. The idea is that you will try to assess someone's level of achievement in some particular area in a way that makes their performance comparable to performance of someone else who also is assessed in the same way. So oftentimes you use the same items. You try to give the test under the same conditions, including the amount of time. You try to control the amount of motivation, though that's frequently impossible to do, so that you can say, for example, if this student performs at a particular level, that's a valid conclusion that is the level, and if that level is higher than another student, then one is outperforming the other. That's what you try to do with standardized tests. Some people think that all standardized tests are multiple choice item tests. This means that the typical thing is you're asked a question, you're given four or five options, and the task for the student is to pick the most right option from the options given, as contrasted to a test that says write this essay, or it's more, sometimes people say, performance oriented. So not all standardized tests are multiple choice tests. That's a confusion I want to clear up right away. The second common confusion is what's called norm reference tests, and that means that the first and most important way of reporting results is to say where is a person's achievement relative to other people's achievement. So you could say they performed at the 95th percentile. That means that they scored better than 95% of the norm group for that test. So those kinds of tests can be standardized tests, but not all standardized tests are multiple choice and or norm reference. Now, having said that, probably most people credit the beginnings of standardized testing to ancient Chinese, and they wanted to select people for jobs in a way that was merit-based rather than family-based.
Mm-hmm.
But standardized tests now, as you know, there are these international comparisons of student achievement. All of those are standardized tests. The two main ones are PISA and TIMSS. TIMSS is focused on math and science, and PISA is focused on how students are achieving at age 15 in various countries. So those are examples, and there are 40, 50 countries that participate on a regular basis in those standardized test assessments. But standardized tests are also an integral part of the reporting and monitoring of student performance in lots of countries, New Zealand, Australia, Germany, to name a few.
But now, with the something like the PISA, it's just done at random. In other words, a random sample.
That's
as
right.
Opposed to every kid. And so I would think with a performance-oriented, that would be quite expensive to grade if you were giving every single kid one of them.
We do it, though. And you're right, it is somewhat expensive. Every one of the states that I'm working with that I mentioned earlier on their tests have multiple choice items and they have performance events, some of which they call extended response, which takes a student 15 or more minutes to complete. And these are scored by trained readers, and the accuracy of those scores are monitored over time to make sure that they are accurate. But there's a lot of advancing now in which these performance events are scored through what some people call artificial intelligence. They're scored by the computer.
It can do a writing, a scoring a writing, an essay?
Yes, ma'am.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
Huh. Very interesting. So, I mean, where have they done any testing of how accurate that is?
Absolutely.
Well, what would you say have been some of the factors in the growth of standardized testing in this country?
Well, the biggest boost to the amount of standardized testing in K-12 schooling had to come from the No Child Left Behind initiative. And what happened there was it required that, phased in over time, schools would come to a point where they tested every student every year in grades 3 through 8 and high school, one grade in high school, in English, language, arts, and reading, mathematics, and then the requirement for science was that they test in at least one grade in the elementary school, one grade in the middle school, and one grade in the high school. And that requirement was the last one to come on, and I think that might have happened in 2008. Well, that's a lot of testing. And if you want to get Title I funds, you had to comply with that program. Prior to that, it was typical for students all across the country in all the districts to take standardized tests, but not every grade level, and it would be every year for a selection of grades was more typically the case.
Then you're saying that the federal government's role actually inspired a lot of testing. But what about the College Board? We never did touch on that.
No, College Boards, of course, I graduated from high school in 1960, and I took those tests, so they've been around for quite a while, and they are standardized tests, and They're still around. And then there are a lot of other standardized tests that are around. For example, the certification tests for doctors and lawyers and architects and landscape architects. All of those are standardized tests. In fact, the Medical Board of Examiners is just two blocks from my office here. So those are important tests. And then to the SATs, we have the ACTs, which I think are now about as prevalent. Those are standardized tests. And not only are they standardized tests, but all of these tests have quite a few multiple choice items on them as well.
So not much performance oriented.
Well, there is some, and in fact, the architect's test for certification was one of the pioneers of having computer administered tests, which gave simulations where people actually did architectural work on the test.
You know, you've talked about the virtues. You said, you know, standardizing helps with fairness. What about the limitations of such testing?
Well, the first thing to say about a test is that the items on it, whether they're multiple choice or performance or whatever, are a sample of all of the possible items that could be asked. You have time constraints and limits. It means that an assessment to be of student achievement to be valid, you want it to have a representative sample of tasks, of all of the kinds of tasks that you want students to be able to complete, all that you want students to know and be able to do. And these days, statements of what it is you want students to know and to be able to do are typically called content standards. And in your introduction to this session, you mentioned, is it called the Common Core?
Oh, I see what you mean, the Common Core State Standards.
Yes. Well, that's exactly right. And I think they've been now, they were written under the guise of the National Governors Association with the assistance of the Council of Chief State School Officers. They wrote one set of standards in English language arts and reading and one in mathematics. And these have now been adopted by the vast majority of states.
Right.
And then you mentioned these two multi-state assessment consortia funded by the government. Both of those consortia are to be building tests that are aligned to these Common Core standards. Previously, every state, according to the law, the No Child Left Behind law, had to have their own challenging academic content standards in English language arts and reading and also science. Now, there's one set for most states. There could be one test, but for whatever reason, the government decided to fund two consortia. It remains they're supposed to deliver their tests in 2014, so it remains to be seen how similar or different they are. But they're both supposed to be valid measures of what the Common Core calls for teachers to teach and students to know and be able to do.
So what criteria would you use to judge them?
Well, the first and foremost thing is you want them to be valid and fair and then reliable. And for student achievement tests, the main criterion for validity is that the test is aligned to the standards. That is to say, the test is a good measure of what the standards call for students to know. It doesn't systematically leave out large chunks of important content. And so there are various ways to measure the degree to which a test is aligned to content standards. One is a way in which I created. It's called, for whatever reason, Surveys of Enacted Curriculum. The other most popular method was created by a colleague of mine, Norman Webb, and it's called the Webb Procedure. But probably these consortia will subject their test to one or the other, or perhaps both of those two criteria for judging alignment. Hopefully they'll be well aligned to the content standards. After that, you want the test to be fair, so the procedures for standardization need to be good. You want them to be efficient so that they aren't too burdensome. And you want them to be reliable, and that means that the scores are, if a student took a different sample of items that are comparable to the sample of items they took, they would have gotten roughly the same score.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they took the test over time, there would be some variability. Some people have a bad hair day or whatever, but they would be roughly the same score over time within a short period of time as well. That's reliability.
Well, now, what about the historical record of the risks of such high-stakes tests? For example, I know you were involved in looking into cheating in Atlanta.
Yeah, right. Well, there are lots of risks in not knowing how students are achieving, and there are lots of risks in knowing how they're achieving, especially if the way that you're going to learn how they're achieving can be manipulated. So cheating is one issue. If, for example, you say, well, I'm going to hold principals and teachers accountable for how well their students achieve, or I'm going to hold whole districts accountable for how well their students achieve, then that creates what people call high stakes for those student achievement scores. And the higher the stakes for the scores, the more motivation there will be to try to cheat. In the College Boards test that you were talking about a little earlier, the stakes are almost all for students. If they do well, they have a better chance of being selected into an institution of higher education of their choice than if they do poorly. So there can be stakes for students, stakes for teachers, stakes for principals. And what happened in Atlanta was that there was a lot of pressure for principals and teachers to have their kids score well, and they did not put in place sufficient safeguards to prevent cheating, and so cheating happened. The main way of cheating looked to be that they changed students' answers from mm-hmm. wrong to right.
What do you see as the future of standardized testing?
I'm not great with a crystal ball. I think everybody is holding their breath for what these two multi-state consortia are going to produce. I originally thought this was a golden opportunity, and there are two things that I really hoped would be accomplished with this new investment in fewer tests. So I thought, well, instead of having 50 states doing their own thing, if we have only one or two tests against one set of standards, there should be lots of efficiencies. We ought to be able to spend more money making the best test possible, and in the aggregate spend way less money. Maybe not just 1/50 as much, but maybe, like 1/4 as much. And here's what I hoped would be done with those efficiencies. One is I wanted what people call computer adaptive testing. What this means is that when a student starts to take a test, they get a handful of items, and that locates roughly their level of achievement. And then they get more items that are at the level where they seem to be functioning. If they start to get more right, they get a little bit harder questions, and vice versa. This does a couple things that are very important. One is it makes the testing more efficient. You can spend way less time testing the student. They have a shorter, so they don't have, they might not have the motivation and the attention problems. In fact, we know that for very young students, you can't have them do a test any more than 10 or 15 minutes. Most of these tests that you and I are talking about are 50 minutes or so, maybe more. So the efficiency and time is good for the student, and it's just a good thing overall. And the other thing is, if you have one test for the whole country or one test for all of Ohio, then there are going to be some places where there are large concentrations of low-performing students, and they will perform at the bottom of the range of that test. In other words, they're really not, we know that they're low achievers, but we're not getting any very precise information about how low they are. In fact, I can tell you that when the National Assessment of Education Progress Test that you mentioned earlier was given in Puerto Rico, it was too difficult a test, and that whole administration was basically wasted because so many of the students scored about a chance. If you have a computer adaptive testing, there will be no floor nor ceiling to your test. The second thing I hoped for was that we could use simulations and animations and the like to make the test a lot more game-like and so a lot more exciting and interesting. What we want to make sure is when a student takes a test, they try their best. And some of these tests can be pretty dull and boring. So I hoped for both of these things. One of the consortia is committed to the computer adaptive testing, so I'm pleased by that. And the other one has been a little bit more ambivalent about it. But it doesn't look like there's going to be the time and the money to really change the character of the test in the way that I was talking about with animations and simulation.
We've been speaking with Andrew Porter, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania and the George and Diane Weiss Professor of Education. In a moment, we hear an argument for tests that are more inclusive and for a national set of standardized assessments. This is Examining Education. This is Examining Education. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. Today's topic is standardized assessment. We're asking, what should be the role of standardized testing? Is its current direction problematic? Our next guest, Laura Slover, is currently Senior Vice President of ACHIEVE. Can you tell us a little about ACHIEVE and about your involvement with the topic of testing?
Sure. ACHIEVE is a nonprofit, bipartisan organization that works with states to advance their education systems at the state level. So we work with state agencies, governor's offices, the business community, and the higher ed community to build an agenda around preparing all students for college and career so that they enter prepared for success in whether they go into a high-skilled career or directly into a 2 or 4-year institution after high school. So we're all about helping states put in place policies and practices that support an environment that will help prepare students for success.
So what problems do you see with the current state of testing in our schools?
Well, the current state of testing in our schools is very focused on a narrow set of skills. And I think, generally speaking, the public has become a little disenchanted with assessments in a number of states, not in all, certainly, but because they focus on a narrow set of skills and don't fully reflect the broad set of things that are most critical to preparing students for college and careers. And by that I mean rich performances like writing, doing research, doing extended problem solving in mathematics, really getting at critical thinking and reasoning, the things that post-secondary faculty and employers say are in fact the most important things that will indicate that students are ready for good jobs or to go into credit-bearing courses. And the current assessments don't really do that. In many cases, they are multiple-choice questions only that require students to select from a number of options but not to do any real work on their own. And in many cases, they're quite short and don't really give students the chance to show what they know and what they can do.
So then the changes you'd recommend would be?
Well, the changes that I'd recommend are, there are multiple sets of changes. And in regards to measuring the things that matter most, I think assessments really need to move from kind of measuring rote learning and the ability to regurgitate facts and figures and solve simple equations to really tapping students' ability to, as I said, to write using sources and to really have them be able to do extended and long sessions of writing that reflect their ability to draw evidence from a variety of sources, synthesize that evidence, evaluate bias and credibility of those sources, and to use the evidence from those sources to marshal an argument or to make a case for something.
Do you see it possible to use standardized testing for this? Because wouldn't judging writing be very expensive? I know Illinois, for example, has dropped their writing.
A number of states have unfortunately dropped kind of extended assessments that they're in some cases called performance tasks. And I think in the future vision of testing, it's going to be important to make sure that those kinds of tasks are incorporated. Because if you think about it, they really reflect the kinds of things the public cares about. The public cares much more about students' ability to use its knowledge and apply it to novel situations than whether a student can just reflect on and memorize a fact. So these kinds of assessments are going to be critical if we're going to move our education system to really being one of preparing students for good jobs, the ability to go to college, and frankly, just the preparation to be a good citizen and live in the world.
Is your organization proposing doable tests for various states?
Chief is working as the project management partner for a consortium of 24 states that are working together to develop common assessments. Typically, assessments have been developed state by state, and each state has its own set of academic standards. It develops its own set of assessments to match them, and it reports statewide results only within a state. These states, in what's called the Partnership for the Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, otherwise known fondly as PARCC, P-A-R-C-C, are working to develop assessments that will be administered across the states so that results can be compared and best practices can be shared. What's different about this test, in part, is that it's focused on a set of common standards. So they're moving from 24 sets of standards to one common set of standards. Additionally, the assessments will really be anchored in what it takes to be prepared for college and career readiness, so that at the end of high school, that last set of tests that students take really will provide an indication of their readiness for credit-bearing courses in college and will signal both to students, teachers, and parents whether their students are ready, but also to higher education about whether students are ready to enter directly into credit-bearing courses. So we think it's an important way to articulate and create better alignment between high schools and colleges. Back mapping from those assessments at the high school level will be a set of assessments that go all the way back down to the third grade, and they'll be what's called vertically aligned so that they'll really be able to show along a progression from third grade all the way up to the end of high school where students are on their pathway to readiness for college and careers. And that will help send signals really early if students are falling off their path, so that teachers and parents can help students by supporting them and helping them get back on track.
You know, you are kind of using college and career together as though they would be exactly the same. What I'm wondering about is differentiating students.
Well, I think that there's been a large amount of research, particularly done by ACT in the last few years, that has shown a convergence of what it means to be ready for college and what it means to be ready for high-skilled careers. There's certainly variation between a myriad of careers, but there's a common set of core knowledge and skills that help provide a foundation for that preparation. And so when I talk about college and career readiness, I'm talking about that kind of broad set of pretty robust and rigorous knowledge and skills that will prepare students for success and be door openers so that they have choices when they get to the end of high school. Assessments that the consortium is going to be building will be aligned to these standards that are really focused on preparing all students. And so that's one important way in which they're different from current assessments. In some states, assessments are not aligned to be door openers in that way. And in fact, a number of states have exit exams that are pegged at a lower level, perhaps at the 10th grade, or in some cases, assessments that students may take in the 10th grade but reflect content that they've learned much earlier in their school career. These assessments will be really pegged at that level. They'll also be internationally benchmarked, so they can show states students are achieving compared to students in other countries.
Well, what criticisms have you found of doing this?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, people are, it depends on who you ask. I mean, certainly there is a constituency in this country that is opposed to testing of any sort. But within the range of individuals who believe that assessments can be useful in helping pinpoint student successes and also targeting appropriate interventions, I think there's a lot of excitement about these assessments. One thing that's important to note is that the assessments I'm talking about that will be developed by the PARC Consortium will be technology-based, so they'll be delivered on a computer. That will ease the administration challenge. It will enable much quicker turnaround of results, which is often something that you hear states and parents in particular complain about. Their kids take tests, but they don't get results until sometime, you know, very late in the summer, by which point it's a little bit of a moot point how well they did on their May assessment or an assessment they took in April. These, because they will be administered online, will be able to provide much quicker results so that parents and teachers will have those results by the end of the year. It will also allow, a technology-based platform will allow much more innovations in terms of item types. The computer can be used to do simulations. It can be used to really do extended problem solving in mathematics using mathematical tools. So we're envisioning these as really innovative and exciting assessments that won't look like the assessments people are used to. And to that extent, folks are getting quite excited about them and thinking about them as the next generation in testing.
But what about extended responses, writing? That's really usually very slow to grade.
So there'll be a series of what we're calling performance-based assessments, and those will include direct writing, using a variety of sources, doing a little research, thinking about extended problems that are scenario-based. In mathematics, they'll include, as I said earlier, a lot of extended multi-stage problems that really require students to apply what they've learned, using the tools from their mathematical toolbox, if you will, to solve new and interesting problems. In many cases, those will require human scoring. There's also a lot of research and development around artificial intelligence scoring, or automated scoring, as it's called. And there'll be a number of research studies done over the next few years to help the consortium determine the extent to which that method of scoring can be used to, A, speed up the scoring process, and B, drive down cost. So it's a very exciting time in assessment. There's a lot of new opportunity and a lot of research being done.
I'm going to mention some criticisms that I've heard and see how you would counter these. Some people are worried that these tests are going to be used to judge teachers. Do you think it's fair to use them in this way?
Well, here's what I'll say about that. How states use the assessments is an individual state-level decision and a state policy question. It is important, however, to note that any assessment that's going to be used for the sake of evaluating teachers needs to measure what really matters and what the standards say and what teachers are required to teach. And to that extent, I think these assessments will do that in a much better, more holistic way than perhaps assessments have done in the past. If you're going to use assessments, let's make sure they're meaningful and that they measure what matters most and that they align very closely with what teachers are teaching and doing in the classroom. The vision for these assessments is that they will be seamlessly connected to the work in schools, that teachers, if they're doing a good job instructing students around the standards, shouldn't be surprised by what's on the test, and students shouldn't be surprised either. That it becomes a part of a much broader system and will provide feedback to students. One of the aspects of the PARC assessment system is a set of diagnostic assessments that teachers can use at any time during the year to get data about their individual students and help chart them chart a path of success for them. And that's a really exciting piece of the broader system.
You were saying that you felt that current testing narrows the curriculum too much. Then I take it that these tests will be done in a wider number of fields than just reading and math?
Well, I think I said that the current tests are often considered quite narrow and that they don't assess the full range of what is taught. They focus in on particular aspects of that. And these assessments, although they will be given in English language arts, which is reading and writing, and mathematics, those are the topics they'll be given in, will have much greater range and depth. So they'll do a better job of assessing the full set of academic standards that a student is taught during a given year. I think this is a really key time in the sort of history of public education in general, and in particular around standardized testing. We now have 44 states in the District of Columbia and several territories who have adopted a common set of academic standards in mathematics and in English language arts, reading and writing. And that enables great collaboration in ways that have never really been achieved in this country. And it provides the opportunity to build economies of scale by collaborating on building products and tools to support teachers in the classroom, to drive student achievement, and to build assessments that can measure, finally, what matters most and what we value most as a society. And that ultimately will help drive better student outcome.
We've been speaking with Laura Slover, Senior Vice President of ACHIEVE, an organization created in 1996 by the nation's governors and corporate leaders to help states raise academic standards and graduation requirements, improve assessments, and strengthen accountability. Coming up, we hear about what some feel are the limits to testing, how modern-day testing has in fact damaged the education process, and the direction testing should go. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley, and this is Examining Education. Examining Education. Today's topic is standardized assessment. We're asking, what should be the role of standardized testing? Is its current direction problematic? Are there ways to make testing better? Our next guest, Monty Neal, is currently Executive Director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, FairTest. Can you tell us a little about FairTest and about your involvement in the topic of testing?
Yes, FairTest is a nonprofit organization and advocacy group seeking to ensure that the assessment and evaluation of students and teachers and other school people is fair, open, and educationally beneficial. We believe that the current regimes of standardized tests are harmful. There is too much testing, and the consequences are more harmful than beneficial. We think there's important roles in education for assessment and evaluation. And we think there are far better ways to do it than with the current heavy reliance on standardized tests.
Well, what do you see as the motives behind the current push for standardized testing?
Well, there are, in fact, visibly multiple motives. There are people who believe correctly that there's often inadequate educational opportunities for low-income children in this country, recent immigrants, students with disabilities, children of color. And that something needs to be done to improve it, and they kind of bought the idea of accountability, and the using standardized tests as the basis for accountability would sort of put the pressure on schools to work harder and smarter and do a better job. Again, we don't think that's actually what happened. At the other end of the spectrum, there are people who openly claim that using standardized tests would show up schools as bad and lead to helping to end public schools and replace it with a voucher system. So the motives behind this wave of standardized tests that has really escalated since the No Child Left Behind law was enacted in 2002, the motivations behind it are complex and multifold. But the important thing here, I think, is that the any positive goals, if you view them in terms of improved educational outcomes, have not been realized, while a lot of collateral damage has happened. Many of us predicted all of this collateral damage would, in fact, occur, and we'd love to have been proven wrong, but we were not.
Well, when you say collateral damage, can you elaborate?
The fundamental forms of collateral damage are teaching to the test and narrowing the curriculum. And the third is making unfair decisions about individuals. But because NCLB focuses on schools, that is not so much affected directly individuals, but it's setting the stage for that. Now, in terms of teaching to the test, essentially you have to understand that the existing tests are primarily or entirely multiple choice tests. They are measure pretty superficial aspects of knowledge. They don't measure deeper understanding. They don't measure the ability to analyze, synthesize, evaluate, or create knowledge. They don't tell you whether someone can apply knowledge. So on this very little slice of information in the tested subjects, what happens in order to boost the test scores is a lot of teaching to the test, and what that means is that the very limited areas of teaching, or what ought to be limited areas of teaching and learning, overwhelm the classroom. So you have schools that are literally reduced to test prep programs. And the kids are therefore cheated out of a high-quality education. Now, not all of them were getting a high-quality education before. That's certainly true. But it hasn't worked to make things better. And there are plenty of kids whose older siblings or they themselves at a younger age were getting a better education than they are now because of the pressure of the tests. The second thing that happens is the narrowing of the curriculum. The No Child Law says that the reading and math tests are the ones that count when you judge schools. They require three grades of science testing, but those don't have to count, and some other states do some other testing, and some of that counts in some cases. But the main emphasis here has been on the reading and the math in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. And so what we have seen, and it's been documented by several different researchers, is a narrowing of the curriculum. So, for example, essentially untested subjects get less time, almost down to no time, and tested subjects, that's where all the emphasis is. So you spend more time on reading, more time on math, less time on science, less time on social studies. The arts tend to get cut out. Recess tends to get reduced, and we know many cases of schools that have eliminated recess for younger children. So that kind of narrowing of the focus, inordinate spending of your time sitting at desks doing worksheets, it's just simply counterproductive. It turns kids off for learning. They don't learn any better. But unfortunately, educators are really desperate because of an irrational accountability system where if the scores don't go up faster than anybody believes is possible, then you suffer punitive sanctions. So that has fueled both teaching to the test and a narrowing of the curriculum. Now, it plays out with individuals in ways that, for example, it has been documented in research and in court cases, driving kids out of school so that they won't be there by expelling them or suspending them, so they won't be there when the test is taken. And those kind of things hurt the kids, obviously. Putting kids in special ed so they won't get tested, or more severe categories of special ed, though there's a lot less of that now because the federal law requires those kids to be tested. More states have gone to deciding grade promotion based on test scores, but all the research evidence is that holding kids back in grade not only harms their self-esteem, not only makes it more likely that they're going to drop out of school, but does not improve even their test scores 3 years down the road and further. And now we're seeing also a push from the Federal Department of Education to use student test scores to judge teachers. There's a whole series of flaws on that. A plug here, if you go to our website, fairtest.org, you'll see a lot of fact sheets on all the topics that I'm talking about if you want more information. But for essentially judging teachers by student test scores is badly flawed. They're badly flawed because the tests aren't good enough, which is true for judging students in schools. They're also flawed because essentially they can't take account of the student's background. Students are not randomly assigned to teachers, and the result means that the scores that teachers get are totally erratic. For example, though the quarter of the teachers in the bottom 20% might end up in the top 20% the next year. I mean, this is not rational. So what we see all the way down the line, from the quality of the test and what the test measures, to the way it holds schools accountable, to the way it's damaging curriculum and instruction, to the way it's hurting individual students and individual teachers, everywhere down the line, we're seeing more and more damage. And the end results, as I said this earlier, but the end results have not been an improvement. For example, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, it's a test, yes, but it's done on a sampling basis. There's no coaching for this test. It doesn't directly affect the curriculum. And every state participates now in reading and math at grades 4 and 8. And what we have seen since the start of No Child Left Behind is that the rate of improvement compared to the previous decade has slowed down. It's come to a complete halt in some subjects and for some groups within the test. They report the scores by the racial ethnic groups, by students with disabilities, English language learners, poverty rates. And what we see is while the state tests scores get inflated because of teaching to those tests, when the same groups of kids take NAEP, their scores are basically flattening out.
Well, let me ask you this, though. Do you see any need for comparing performances from state to state and nation to nation? And if there is a need, what sort of test would you propose?
Well, NAEP is okay. I think there's improvements that could be made to NAEP. But the notion of sampling students from different states in order to compare them is reasonable. And internationally, there's some useful evidence. Now, there's been two major tests, and they don't always have the same kinds of results, partly because they're organized rather differently. There's one called PISA, and it is ostensibly more on higher-order thinking skills. They've done it in language arts, in math, and in science, if I remember correctly. There's the third and soon-to-be fourth international math and science studies, and those are more strictly content-based. They're all multiple choice in math and science. But nonetheless, there are some countries that tend to be doing very well on these various tests. Finland is one. Singapore is another one. Korea is another one. Japan's generally quite good. But it's interesting. Finland basically does not use standardized tests at all. They do a little bit of sampling every now and then. The only tests are for college admissions, and you don't even have to take those if you don't want to.
How would you try to bring all states up to the same level?
Well, I think that is something of if you have public information out there, that will help. But here's the other thing. We know from decades of research that has never been controverted that about three-quarters of what determines student outcomes is stuff that happens outside of schools. Schools account for 25% to 30% of the difference in outcomes. Now, obviously, you're going to school to learn, so it's not that if you stay home you'll learn necessarily. It's what I'm talking about is whether or not poor kids end up catching up or not to richer kids. The schooling alone is not going to solve that. Now, if you take different states, Mississippi is a vastly poorer state than Massachusetts. The people come in that state are in deeper poverty on average, and the schools have far less resources on average than they do in Massachusetts. So, and this is an order across the country of 3-1 between districts in different states. So that, for example, there are districts in New York and Massachusetts that are spending $20,000. There's districts in other states that are spending $5,000. And the people getting spent with less money being spent on them typically are poorer kids. So if we want to talk about equalizing or increasing the odds of equalizing the outcomes, the absolute first thing that we cannot ignore is the fact that this country has a poverty rate of 25% for its children. Mm-hmm. Finland has a poverty rate of under 5% for its children. The United States is by far the worst major industrial country in its poverty rates, far less than anything in Western Europe. We look more like Mexico than we look like Western Europe. It's really pathetic. And there are lots and lots of kids who are not getting proper nutrition, who lack dental care, who don't go to the doctor often enough, who have to move all the time because of issues with landlords and where they can stay, and that disrupts their schooling. These things have all been measured. The kids who don't get a good summer program and fall behind in the summer, whereas well-to-do kids actually are known to advance their test scores even when they're not in school because of the kind of summer programs they have, whereas poor kids fall further behind. If we're focusing on boosting test scores, we're not going to get high-quality teaching and instruction. So this is not going to work as a tool of improving the quality of teaching or learning. Then, we do have proposals as Fair Test, and other groups that have similar kinds of proposals. We have a fact sheet on our website, Better Ways to Evaluate Schools, for example. And essentially what we say is, here's three ways of looking at how well schools are doing that provide different kinds of information that can be used in different ways. The first thing to note is, if you want to know how well kids are doing, look at what they actually have done in school. Look at what the curriculum is, what the teacher's instructional practices are, what she expects the kids to do, what the kids actually do. How do you know that? You can observe, but you can also look at the work the kids actually do, the teacher's curriculum guide, and so on. If you compile samples of that from classrooms, well-organized, with a guiding structure that guides the teachers about the kind of evidence of student learning to put in there, you can then fairly evaluate those and get a pretty good picture of what the teacher is doing. That's much, it has a little less reliability, that is consistency, than standardized tests, but the richness of the information is vastly better, and so it is a much more valid measure and indicator of how well kids are doing. Very limited amounts of standardized tests should be part of the mix. It's a cheap tool to do a few things, okay, but no stakes attached to them. And the last thing is some kind of an inspectorate or school quality review where teams of experts go into schools, evaluate them, and provide guidance for improvement. So that'll be our three-part program for using assessment and evaluation to improve schools.
We've been speaking to Monty Neal of Fair Test, a nonprofit advocacy organization dedicated to preventing the misuse of standardized tests. Our topic today was standardized testing in our schools. We have a website, examiningeducation.org, where you can listen to past programs, find out more about our speakers, follow links to other websites with more details about issues raised in our discussions, and where you can send us your suggestions and comments. You can also find us on Facebook, Examining Education. Our managing editor is Jason Croft. We had audio support from Mike Pritchard. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. This is Examining Education.